If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
Yeah, so I brought two books today, and they are very special to me. One is called The Treasury of American Wines. It's published in 1973 by Crown, and it's largely been forgotten, and it is one of the iconic books of wine literature in America, and arguably the most important book since the repeal of Prohibition. The other book is called The Pro Football Experience. It is a genuine coffee table book, and it was edited by the iconic NFL executive David Boss.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 565. This week we feature Philip McConnell, sommelier at The Chef's Table, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Today's interview revolves around two books, one about wine and the other not. I'll leave you with that. Our guest for this podcast is sommelier Philip McConnell of The Chef's Table in Walker's Point, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Philip's love of wine is fully intertwined with his love of books. Philip came by the studio to give us his thoughts on one of the most important books written about wine. Maybe it's time we all expand our library of wine authors. You can also hear Philip on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term wine. Well, we're back at the studios of Life Between the Vines, soon to be moved to a new location, but for now, we're still in downtown Milwaukee. I am here with sommelier Philip McConnell, and Philip is a sommelier at Chef's Table here in Milwaukee in the Walker's Point neighborhood. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say, yeah.
Well, thank you for being on the program, Philip. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And the first question, when it comes to your particular occupation, I like to ask, explain to our listeners who may not know, and I'm sure most everybody does by now, what is a sommelier?
A sommelier is a person who helps a wine client, a wine customer, a guest, really, in a restaurant setting, have a great experience. And I come from this from a background of hospitality. My dad was in hotels. So I look at it as helping someone enjoy their experience. Wine is one part of that. It's an important part. And I do everything I can to bridge that gap.
I'm sure often you get guests that are flummoxed or I'm sure a bit intimidated by someone who has this knowledge of wine. Like in any profession, a doctor intimidates us. A policeman can intimidate us. It's just the idea of you know something they don't. How do you soften that when you talk to somebody?
Yeah, you know, I find just the act of engaging them on a topic not related to wine goes a long way. You know, my dad really impressed on me the importance of connecting with your guests. And I think that really helps. Like, when people come in, I try to connect with them so that before we ever get around to talking about wine, they already have some sense that this isn't someone who is hung up on how much they know or hung up on their ego. They're interested in me having a good time.
I admire that idea, and forgive me for this comparison, but it is a bit like a salesman's job when really you have to sell yourself to somebody before you sell a product. As a sommelier, you're really doing that just by simply being kind to somebody and not making them feel intimidated.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other part of that answer really is storytelling, and I am a storyteller at my core. So I think when you get to that point, you can frame a lot of wine information within a narrative, and it doesn't feel like you're just throwing esoteric facts at them.
Sure, you need to make it, what would I say, digestible, but in an easy way. Yeah, it's not castor oil.
And I love that challenge.
Yeah, I bet. It's got to be a lot of fun. Well, you're at Chef's Table, which, again, is this event center. It's not really a restaurant per se. Would it be fair to say that, or?
It is a restaurant. It is a fusion, really, to put it in some Milwaukee, Wisconsin context, of supper club and fine dining and family-style restaurant. So it's a unicorn. We are almost exclusively private. Having said that, we help you design the kind of restaurant event you want to have. Can be a special date night for two people. Can be a retirement party for someone you know very well with 50 people.
Yeah, I was at an event, I mentioned this to you, a mutual friend, Jeff McClone, who is also the co-founder with me from Life Between the Vines from many years ago.
Nice.
And his retirement party was held there. And it first thing that knocked my socks off was just going to the door.
Yes.
And being greeted by two people. I mean, you kind of had to knock to get in.
Yes. There's definitely a speakeasy feel. Yeah. The other cool thing, and our staff just loves this, is the building is so nondescript. So it really is a very powerful example of that experience when you cross a threshold into a different world. The door opens, you're greeted, and everything immediately transforms you and kind of prepares you for that experience.
That's a really good way to put it. Just going up to the door, I stood there and I'm like, oh, I get it. But it blows you away when you walk in because that is the epitome of being greeted and hospitality.
Yes. In fact, we prefer that people don't even get to the point where they have to knock. You know, we're there ready for them. We see them approaching and we open the door just as they hit the threshold.
Nice. And scare them.
And sometimes give them a little shiver.
Yeah, you don't expect that, especially in a town like Milwaukee. This is, you know, not the most common concept. And you're right, obviously. The building does have a very simple look about it, which makes it so cool when you walk inside and you just stand there and your jaw drops.
Yeah. Sometimes we have people call us from the stoop saying, I've parked nearby. I think I'm nearby. I'm at this nondescript building on the corner. Where do I go from here? And then we just open the door and they're right there.
It's fun. To me, that's really fun. I mean, I think many of us, especially who are involved with wine, would be very frustrated restaurateurs. Not that that's ever possible because it's such a difficult process.
Yeah.
But to have something that has that level of exclusivity, but friendliness.
Yeah, and we pride ourselves on that.
Yeah. That's very cool. Part of your gig is something I'm very envious about, is overseeing, as I understand it, an extensive cellar.
Yes. Yeah, so by my reckoning, we're the third largest restaurant cellar in Milwaukee.
Oh, my.
Hard to get real numbers from folks, you know, but we're somewhere in the 1,800 to 2,000 bottle range, and it's all organized and cataloged. But here's what's kind of cool. There is no wine list per se. We work with you, as I was mentioning, to plan your event. And then I coordinate with the chefs. And we look at the food that you have all agreed to have for the evening. And then I pair each course with a wine from the collection. So the business model, from a sommelier point of view, is something more akin to something you would have seen in Paris or Moscow or New York 100 years ago. I'm over here in the wine cellar buying wine. My directive is just to buy good wine.
Mm.
The day will come, a month later, a year later, 5 years later, when there's the opportunity to use that wine.
Now, primarily we're here to talk about these books, and I want to get to that in a minute, but I do have to focus on the cellar being a wine lover. Can you drop a few names for me?
I would say we're strong in Burgundy and Italian. We don't look so much at producers as we do regions. So we're heavy on Barolo. We've also got a lot of Givre Chambertin. We like some of the volcanic stuff coming out of Italy. We have some older Riojas. But we also look at it as a color wheel.
Mm.
So we've got everything from sparkling to whites to rosés to reds to dessert. So, and then we get into, you know, vintage ports at the end of the spectrum and things like a chem. So I really like to feel like I've got a little bit of everything. So when something comes up, you know, I can dive in and go, well, you know, a great Burgundy from the Chalonnaise region would work. This dish probably needs something, though, that's either had some lees contact. I mean, now I'm sort of in the nerd speak, but lees contact or a little bit of oak aging. Can't do stainless steel for this course, ideally. So we do have some big stuff. California-wise, we try to stay away from getting too heavy on Cabernet because everybody else does that.
Yeah, sure. Any other part of the U.S. at all?
We really like Oregon Pinot.
And
we're starting to get into New York State.
Oh, really? Nice. Finger Lakes or?
Yeah, Finger Lakes for sure. We're going to start to push the envelope. We're still discovering or rediscovering Portugal.
Nice.
And
love Portuguese wines.
Yeah, no, it's they still feel exotic to me, even though I've been doing this for a few years.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Well, because you've got over 200 particular grapes, you've got crazy field blends, you've got all kinds of stuff going on there.
And you still have that deep cultural synergy of the wine working with food.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wonderful wine. I do want to just jump in real quick. Our listeners, once again, they'll notice there are occasional noises going by here. We are in the control room of the studio as opposed to the booth because it's a more comfortable atmosphere. It is Harley Davidson's 100 millionth anniversary, I think, this week. So there may be a bike or two piddling by, just so they know. So be prepared for that, folks. One thing I always love to find out about is the background, where wine wove its way into your particular tapestry. That was a very eloquent way of putting it, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm not going to top that, but I was digging the language there.
Thank you.
As an English lit major, for sure. So I have that story that's very rare. As an American, I grew up with wine. My parents separated when I was very young, and my dad lived in San Francisco in the late 60s. So he got into wine. And then when I would go to visit him on school vacations and whatnot, he would let me have a little glass of wine with food. But he also took me to Napa and Sonoma and probably saw 50 wineries before I was 10.
Wow.
Which that did not launch me, but it just sort of planted a seed. And then did the regular thing in college of drinking too much beer. But the curiosity was always there. And then I had the good fortune, as I was finishing college, to have a couple of wine mentors. And I realized, this is something I really need to explore.
Who were your mentors?
Well, great question. Excuse me. One was a sculptor and the other was a poet.
Really?
So that sort of informs how I look at wine, I suppose. The sculptor is a man named Bobby Joe Scribner, who's now in Northern Illinois. The poet is a man who was also an editor. Turned out to be one of the giants of 20th century American poetry, Michael Cudahy. And I was his assistant for a poetry journal. And those were formative experiences. They really challenged me. They really pushed me. And that was in an era unlike today where if you were learning about something and you said something that was just way off base, they didn't care about your feelings. They would just say, you just said something stupid.
Yeah. Not quite that way these days.
No.
Yeah. You had this background. Not everybody just puts their, bunny slippers on in the morning, not saying you have those, and decide to become a psalm, which is a real challenging gig.
Yeah. I stayed on the path. I tried to stay on the path. I went to graduate school, got a degree to be an archivist. And while I was looking for a job as a professional archivist, I thought, well, I'll go to work part-time at a wine store, because I have all this curiosity. On day one, within the first 15 minutes, as I was dusting bottles, I realized whatever this is, this. And I thought, I'll give it a year. And that was June 6, 1996, and I've never looked back.
Very good.
Excuse me, June 3rd, yeah. Wow. Never looked back.
It's good you remember that. Yeah. When did you get your first certificate?
That would have been 5 years ago, after I came to Milwaukee.
To anybody who knows anything about this, this job of being a sommelier takes the word study and takes it into the stratosphere, in my opinion. Really, you lose your life for a little while, don't you?
You do, and I really had to draw on my academic discipline, self-discipline. And you do feel like you're unplugging from the world for a while.
An awful question. I don't even like asking winemakers this, but I'm going to ask it to you. When you have such a broad background, is there a particular area you lean to as far as your palate goes, what you really enjoy?
I used to deny that was a valid question, and I finally just had to realize I'm just avoiding the truth. I love the varietals, the white varietals in the Rhone Valley.
Nice.
Grenache Blanc, as they call it. We call it white Grenache. They call it Grenache Blanc in France, and it grows wonderfully in northern Spain as well. It just hits the bullseye for me.
Amazing. That's the most unique answer I've had in that question.
Yeah, okay.
And again, I try to avoid it because winemakers just roll their eyes like bourbon.
I thought I somehow had to be above the fray, and I finally decided, why am I telling people that? I actually do love something better more than everything else.
Well, in the end, too, I'm sure you're very similar to other people in that you just do become this broad palate person where everything is enjoyable.
Absolutely.
I'm sure there aren't too many that you would, cast aside.
Yeah, no. And the fascination is always there. The curiosity is always there. And you have to suspend your own judgment for professional reasons, obviously, a lot of the time. But there just is a point where you taste something and you're like, yeah, that works for me. So other side of the coin, if you don't mind, there's something that doesn't work for me. And I have tried over many years, and I've had opportunities to taste great examples. I have a blind spot for Riesling.
Really?
Yeah.
Really interesting.
I just don't want to have it.
Wow.
Yeah. And I've tasted older vintages out of great cellars. I've tasted, top producers that I can't even afford. And the profile just doesn't work for me.
That's very interesting.
And I love sharing that with a lot of guests, because I think there is pressure, especially in a fine dining setting, to feel like you have to like something, you have to appreciate something. And it's a great way to get people off the hook.
Yeah.
No, you don't. You don't have to like it.
Yeah.
You didn't make it. I didn't make it. It's just we're here talking about it.
But you're pulling from your mental catalog.
Yes.
And that's your job is to guide somebody.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Interesting.
People appreciate that.
Yeah. So the main reason you're here is to talk about wine and a couple of books that are special to you. Tell me about what you have here.
Yeah, so I brought two books today, and they are very special to me. One is called The Treasury of American Wines. It's published in 1973 by Crown, and it's largely been forgotten, and it is one of the iconic books of wine literature in America, and arguably the most important book since the repeal of Prohibition. The other book is called The Pro Football Experience. It is a genuine coffee table book. And it was edited by the iconic NFL executive David Boss. David Boss turns out to be central. He was to the first book. He was the vision. He created the vision for the Treasury of American Wines. And the reason these are important to me right now and today, Ray, is that this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Treasury of American Wines.
The connection, as you may have noticed, my reaction was, huh? So now I understand the connection between the two. Well, let's talk about the first book.
Sure.
I love the idea of American Treasury. I'm a big fan of both American and French wines and Italian wines and every other wine I get my hands on. But I see the cover, and this was published 76, did you say?
73.
So this is before the tasting of Paris.
Yes.
And in that regard, ahead of its time.
Yes.
Well, I think that was the vintage of the wines, wasn't it?
A couple of them. Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah.
So tell me about the book.
Yeah. So this book was the brainchild of David Boss. David Boss, for listeners who don't know that name, and they probably don't, David Boss was the person who created marketing for the NFL in the 1960s. And he was ultimately recognized by the Hall of Fame, one of the few people who was not a player to be recognized by the Hall of Fame in Canton. He designed and marketed the NFL at a time when other leagues hadn't even thought about doing that. Any boy who liked football in the 1960s and 1970s had those posters of their favorite team. He designed all those. He designed the covers for the first 25 Super Bowls. He is single-handedly responsible for the imaging of the NFL, probably over a three-decade period. He lived in Los Angeles. Turns out he was a big aficionado of wine. Mm-hmm. So he met the biggest person in Southern California for wine in those circles, a gentleman named Nate Croman. Nate was a Beverly Hills attorney. He created the UCLA Wine Extension Course, which is famous within the wine world for whatever that's worth.
Oh, yeah.
And he created it because he went to UCLA in the early 60s and said, do you have a course that I can take, because he was starting to take wine in a more earnest way. And they said no, and it occurred to him shortly thereafter, well, I'll just ask them if I can create it. And he did. Nate Croman became the regular wine columnist for the LA Times over about a 16-year period. According to his daughter, Lucy, that's about 700 pieces of writing.
I would imagine, yes.
Yeah. He also became very famous in California as a critic of sorts. He was a wine buyer for the legendary Scandia restaurant in Los Angeles in the 70s. And so he wielded a tremendous amount of influence. So David Boss came to him and said, I have this idea for a book. And Nate said, that just feels too big to take on. And David Boss said, no, we're going to do this. And Nate acknowledges him at the end of the book for driving him to accomplish this. They brought in two other gentlemen, and this quartet of four unlikely horsemen put together a book over the course of about 2 or 3 years. They became a runaway bestseller, had tremendous influence, and is important not only for the scope of what it accomplished, but also for presenting on a silver platter the American wine world to the American consumer a couple of years before the famous tasting in 1976, The Judgment of Paris.
A lot of interesting things to unpack from this. The ironic for me is there is a winemaker in Michigan by the name of David Boss. Actually, he was a vineyard manager in Napa for many years,
right.
But went back to his home state. Found that ironic, and he makes some really spectacular wine. The connection to the NFL and wine is these days not as uncommon because there's so many football players that have retired and gone into winemaking, some who really knew what they're doing and others that didn't. When we talk about American wine, especially these days, that's very broad. Many states, obviously you mentioned Oregon, we have Washington, Virginia, my home state of Ohio, a lot of places Texas making some very good wine these days. Back in those days, that was not the case. So I'm just curious how broad this book goes.
So it includes California and I think 8 other states. Mm-hmm. And if you put yourself in the shoes of an editor at Crown in New York City, you would probably tell Nate and David Boss to limit it to just California because it would sell better.
Yeah, sure.
And to their credit, they pushed back and said, no, we feel like in terms of the heritage of this country, it encompasses all the states that are wine-producing states. They may not all be at the same level today, but at some point, many of them will reach a level that we can't even begin to appreciate right now. That was visionary. He mentions Oregon in a very skeptical way, in a sense, and he only mentions 2 wineries, but he says, you know, Oregon could be very special.
Mm.
He only mentions 1 winery for Washington State. So it gives you some idea of how far we've come in 50 years.
A long way. Sometimes we could say thank you, Prohibition. Sometimes we should not say thank you. Yeah. We were just talking about a couple of great books. Leon Adams' book, which is a wonderful book. Wine books these days tend to be more talking about the area, the terroir, the winemaking processes. But we don't really see as much, especially in the United States, at least from what I've seen, books that go into this kind of detail because we have so many great winemakers here. I've been tasting wines from Idaho, which were pretty amazing.
Sure, yeah. Well, I think this book speaks to that in a profound way because the emphasis in Treasury is on the visions of making great wine, regardless of where they are, or even in the state of California, humble beginnings or limited experience. His focus was on the vision of the winemaker and their passion and integrity. And that's one of the reasons the book, in hindsight, is profoundly important because there are no ratings, as we think of them now, in this book.
Mm. Good.
And then once you get to 1976 and the Judgment of Paris tasting, everything changes. So this is an opportunity to go down the rabbit hole, almost time travel, really, 3 years prior to that, and see the state of the American wine industry. California, I think, only had about 250 wineries in 1973, which is interesting because that was less than the number of wineries when Prohibition started. So the industry took a long time to go back. We kind of take it for granted, but that wasn't the case. I should also add, I mean, I'm drawn to books because I went to library school and I love books. But I do have a very deep personal connection with the Treasury book. I knew Nate Croman personally.
Oh, really? Oh.
and counted him among one of my most important mentors. I met Nate in Los Angeles when I was an import buyer for the distributor Wine Warehouse. Nate, a bit of a raconteur, but Nate knew the founding brothers of Wine Warehouse, and he claims he gave them the name Wine Warehouse, but the Meyersons have a different take on it.
Sure.
I bought this book in college, and it was kind of my Bible for learning a little bit more about wine. When I had the opportunity to meet Nate, I ended up going to his house to deliver some wines that he had bought from Wine Warehouse. And I sat at his kitchen table, and I knew this was an opportunity I had waited years for. I had some very specific questions about the book, most of all the tone of it. I studied English literature and was a big Walt Whitman fan, and I felt like there was something very powerful and direct and personal in the way that the Treasury book is written that reminded me of Walt Whitman. And I said, I have to tell you, when I read Treasury, I feel like you're talking to me. And he said, that's because I was. He didn't type this. He narrated the entire book.
Oh, wow.
He had polio. And the easiest thing to do for all of his literary output, the 700 articles for the LA Times, his course material, was to speak into a microphone and then have them dictate it. So this is not only a book on its own merits, it's a rare example of a book that was not written but was narrated. And if you even just read a passage out loud, you will feel like Nate, even though you've never met him, is there in the room talking to you.
A much more conversational way.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
And the book remains fresh in that regard.
Well, as I sit here looking at the book, I see Schramsberg, I see Heights, I see, of course, Inglenook, and all these wonderful wines with vintages that we would sell our souls to get our hands on.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not in print, I'm assuming, anymore, or has it been reissued at all?
Well, it sold so well that they did a second printing in 1976. It has not been released since then. And I sit here today shocked, but also happy to let everybody know you can get it all day on eBay or Amazon for about $5.
Get out of here.
Yes.
Well, you've just made my day, because I will hop on Amazon and purchase this book.
Yes.
That's astounding.
Yes. Yeah, and I think it's something we used to take for granted. I think the digital age has destroyed that. And here I get on a bit of a soapbox, but this book has been lost to maybe two generations of wine professionals now. One of the first questions I always ask, in a very polite way, when I meet someone who's got really high credentials, if they're under the age, forgive me, of 35, you know, I'll say, well, have you ever read Treasury American Wines? And people have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah. No, I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely under 35.
I got you at 37 or 38, right?
Yeah, you're a good man.
Yeah. So this book is profoundly important to me. I have started a project with a friend and colleague. Her name is Christine Graham. We've known each other for about 25 years now. She's actually based in Pasadena. I met her when I was working with Wine Warehouse. And we have started something called the Treasury Project. You know, it would be easy to say this is the 50th anniversary. Let's celebrate it this year with one simple brushstroke of activity. But this book really lends itself to deep exploration. I don't know how long this project's gonna go on. Christine and I have envisioned many different things to do. Being here with you today is one of those things for sure. We wanna have a tasting at some point or a wine dinner, you know, certainly with some of the great wineries even that are on the cover there. We are in touch. We've started to reach out to all of the wineries that are profiled in this book. At least the ones that are still in existence. This book profiles 120 different wineries.
Mm. That's still quite a few for that period of time.
Absolutely. No, this was a Herculean task.
I bet it was.
And it took the better part of 3 years. So to us, it is the 50th anniversary, and that's very special. But it's really the Treasury Project. The only thing I can relate it to, and I'm really going to put on my University of Chicago nerd cap here, but the University of Chicago started the Dictionary of the Assyrian Language, I think back in the 1930s. And they didn't know how long it was going to take. So I was reading the alumni notes one day in 2011, and here was a little bulletin letting everybody in the community know that, guess what? We have finished the Assyrian Dictionary.
Wow. So, you know, that's the kind of thing these projects are, labor of love, passion project, yeah, whatever you want to call it. You put your heart into it, and it is Homer. It's the journey.
Yes, absolutely. So we don't know where this project's going to end. We're just going to have fun with it, and Christine and I are excited. Just to give you one little tiny example. Well, actually, there is one story from this book, ironically, even though people don't know the book per se, there's one story coming out of this book that is very well known, and I'm sure you know it. So this was the work of four people. David Boss said, I'm going to find a great photographer. And he had been doing some work with a guy who made a living as a garage mechanic in Oakland, who was very interested. You see where this train's going. This garage mechanic was very interested in photography and had studied, in fact, with Ansel Adams. So he was taking his craft to a pretty high level. And David Boss outlined the project. And this man took his $2,500 advance from Crown Publishers and bought a piece of land in Rutherford. And he and his wife started, and two sons, the third son's not in the wine business, they started Cake Bread Winery. So that's one example of the seismic impact of this book. Would Jack and Dolores have gotten into wine without this book? Yeah, probably, but it might have been 5 or 10 years down the road, and it would have looked totally different, and we wouldn't have the iconic winery that we have now.
That's a great story. And Bruce Cakebread is an extraordinary guy. Lucky to interview him a couple times. And we could talk for days. So, Philip, I'm sure our listeners are going to want to learn more about this. This book has me salivating a bit already. So if they'd like to learn more about you and this project, how would they do that? Website, email?
Sure. For Charters Ray, I'll give my email. It's the letter P for Philip. Then my middle name, Scott, with two T's. And then my last name, McConnell. McConnell. So it's pscottmcconnell@gmail.com. And happy to answer any questions. The project doesn't have a website yet. It will at some point. We're still trying to formulate it. As I mentioned, we're going to start by reaching out to everybody. We have worked with the families a little bit. We've written to Dennis Cakebread. Haven't heard from him yet, but he's a busy guy, so I'm sure we will. You know, I feel a little bit like somebody spreading the gospel. But what I would love as a takeaway from this more than anything, if I never even heard from anybody, would be to go out, buy two copies of this book. It's going to set you back $10. Copy for yourself and give it to somebody. This might be, Wine Folly is a very special book, as we all know. But give this book to somebody and you will give them an opportunity that they will always be grateful for.
That's great. It's chilling to even think about this. Philip, thanks very much.
You're
for
welcome. Appreciate the opportunity. Yeah.
You can contact Philip by email at pscottmcconnell@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Pascoff. Our web geek is Dan Gisha. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2023.